Commander Edmunds Riedel, 4.
So we had plenty of time to select the mode, and we decided to use a fully automatic mode for Seawolf. That is, that the system detected the aircraft, allocated the missile system, chose when to fire the missiles, and that would be the end of it. There was nothing, no need for us to do anything except monitor the engagement. But the back of our minds, we always knew that there was a software defect that we had seen during trials and during earlier exercises, and that if that software defect emanated, we would have a very short space of time in which to reset the system. And you could imagine the horror when it all started to go wrong. And indeed, we couldn't get the system back online by the time the aircraft were at bomb release range. And we were having to engage them with our poor old 4060s, who were 6 years older than I was, and a vast range of GPMGs and other small arms weapons on deck. Three of the bombs missed us entirely, but one bomb bounced on the water and came up through the side of the ship, just right down aft by the flight deck, and went through the MBCD store, went through the two-deck passageway, through the fire main and water main, through the Chinese tailor's shop, up through the flight deck, took the front off a Lynx helicopter was there, and the front off a torpedo, out over the side and into the sea. Now, that was like a hot knife through butter. I mean, we couldn't feel anything at the front of the ship where most of us were. And indeed, I don't even think the bomb went off when it fell in the water on the other side. And with most people taking cover or occupied for some time, we didn't realize that the ship had been damaged at all. I mean, there was no perceptible decrease in movement or power, and no systems went offline. And it couldn't have hit a probably less important part of the ship. Yes, the flight crew would be worried about the flight deck, but as far as the ship's fighting ability was concerned, it didn't do any damage whatsoever, other than two big holes, one on the flight deck and one on the side. However, the Coventry had been aware that we had not provided the defence for ourselves that we would be providing for her. And already the second pair of Skyhawks, who were about 3 or 4 minutes behind the first pair, had moved out in a dogleg. And Coventry had called the cat down to take out the second pair. And in fact, the Combat Air Patrol had called Judy, which means they had acquired the aircraft and had locked onto them, and that their Sidewinder missiles were ready to fire, when somebody in the Coventry called Birds Affirm. Now, this indicates that the CNART system has acquired the aircraft and is also ready to fire. The rules are that if the aircraft are within the missile engagement zone of the ship, even if the Combat Air Patrol is ready to shoot, you haul the Combat Air Patrol off to preserve their weapons and fuel and use your own missile system. So the Combat Air Patrol was hauled off, much to their horror and disgust, because they were just about to shoot these two guys down. And me, being only vaguely aware of the damage down aft and hearing this air defense chat going on my radio net, had this time selected a different mode for Seawolf and decided to manually acquire both aircraft with the Seawolf system, so there would be no hope that we would fall foul of the particular software problem that we sometimes had in fully automatic. And I was locked onto the aircraft when they were some 20 miles away from us. And then it really was only a matter of time. Directly they came within range, Seawolf would shoot them down. And it was with some horror that Coventry then turned to starboard and crossed our bows, therefore effectively, as opposed to us screening her from landward, she was between us and the land, and even worse, between me and the incoming aircraft. We still weren't worried because she had called that her CDART system was locked on, and therefore we expected to fire CDART any second, which would be the end of the two aeroplanes. But she didn't. She started to fire her gun, which made us realize that things weren't going well, steamed across our line of sight from our fire control system to the aircraft, and being a radar transmission, of course, she broke the bore sight, so our system reset. And in no time at all, the aircraft arrived, some 10 seconds later. And of the four bombs they dropped, certainly three hit the Coventry. And they all exploded deep down in the ship. And when she came out of the smoke and so forth, she really looked quite normal. And the bombs had gone in at the base of the foremast, had plunged down three decks into the diesel generator and engine room spaces, had gone off, and we now know blown a sort of 40-foot hole in, what, 20 to 40-foot hole in the bilge keel. And she was rapidly filling with water. And, of course, all her main engines had stopped. And she just came to a halt in the water, with a lot of people on the upper deck looking quite puzzled as to what had happened after this huge explosion. It was quite clear, though, that she was in a bad way, because she started to list very quickly, and they abandoned ship. And in no time at all, we decided to stop. The Argentine aircraft had departed, being chased by the aeroplanes, by our own Sea Harriers. And within 20 minutes, she had turned turtle, was upside down, and we had all our boats in the water. We'd called up for help from San Carlos water, and some 13 helicopters turned up and did a search over the area in which we were, picking people out of the water. And it's quite remarkable, having seen the photographs of the explosion, that actually very few people were killed. And out of those that were killed, very few were injured. And some, I can't remember now, but some only 18 to 20 people were killed, and everybody else was rescued. The sad thing was, we'd lost a Type 42 for the loss in that particular air raid of probably only one aircraft. We know that one of the aircraft that flew over us was so riddled with small arms fire, and we could smell the aviation spirit all over the ship as it had leaked. Didn't get home because it ran out of fuel. So in that particular exchange, it was one aircraft, one ship. But that should be set against the fact that Coventry that day had been responsible for the loss of five Argentinian aeroplanes, and another one from us makes six, which is a balance. More ships were coming down from the UK. No more aircraft were being supplied to the Argentinians. So it's a balance in war as to loss of aeroplanes to ships. Ships are very expensive. But on the other hand, by the 25th of May, the Argentine Air Force had probably just about had enough. Of course, what we didn't know is that later that day, the Atlantic Conveyor was also hit by Exocets and caught fire and eventually sank as well. And the significance of the loss of the Atlantic Conveyor didn't mean anything to us. I mean, it was just a storeship, because we now knew it was carrying all the Chinook helicopters and, of course, all the tents for the troops at the end of the war. But to us, it was just, you know, well, at least it wasn't a warship. But a ship that size, of course, could carry so much, so many stores, that really the 25th of May, the Argentinians could probably consider their one and only good day. Thereafter, Admiral Woodward decided Type 22s and Type 42s operating like that was definitely a bad idea. Although I rather think he was a bit harsh on the combination of ships. To us, it worked well, and we felt that it was a policy worth pursuing, a tactical policy worth pursuing. And we were recalled to rejoin the carrier group on the 26th of May, steamed up and down, showing them our numerous battle scars. We repaired our flight deck, repaired our helicopters. We had three on board by that stage that were damaged, and we managed to get two flying out of the three. And thereafter, we remained in the close company of the Hermes. And were only privy to what was going on inshore, either care of the World Service or care of daily sitraps. And there clearly was a lot of frustration in the ships operating around the carriers of the lack of information. And I distinctly remember the RFA Commodore. Again, I forget the RFA Commodore in the Fort Austin, talking to Admiral Woodward on the radio net, saying, you know, you never tell us what's going on. You know, the only thing we ever get is what's coming out of the World Service. You know, some information would be extremely valuable. You know, a daily sitrep for the non-combatants and the non-involved. And thereafter, things picked up. The other sort of irritants were that our helicopters were rarely used. The Sea Kings were flying overtime, and the Lynx helicopters were getting less flying training than they would in peacetime. And we raised this issue with the flagship, and more sort of helicopter patrols were organized using the Lynx helicopters. And to put it bluntly, we were extremely well off for helicopters. And better tasking could have perhaps provided better cover. I think it became quite frustrating for us in Broadsword thereafter, because a lot of things were happening and we weren't really ourselves involved. And it gave us a lot of time to look at the operations that were going on. I mean, we were as well qualified as people in the flagship. And with the information that we had, it was very clear to us that the flagship staff were heavily loaded. And we offered some of our staff officers over to the flagship to, you know, ease the thinking and the planning. It was never taken up, unfortunately. We had the only qualified electronic warfare officer in the whole of the task force. To be an SD, electronic warfare, special duties electronic warfare officer, was a new branch. We had one, nobody else did. We offered his services, but it was not taken up. So we became a little bit of just bystanders, providing this goalkeeping role on the Hermes. And we were able a little bit more to review also what had gone on. And it became apparent to us that many of the ships that had gone down from the very beginning were surviving quite well. But by this stage, of course, new ships were coming down who were very much more hyped up than we were. And often as not, it was the new ships that arrived very excited with kit that we provided in the UK and all sorts of things that we didn't have, who suffered considerably more, firstly, from damage. A classic case was the Antelope, who first day in San Carlos was sunk. Or suffered more cases of stress because they had more time to be worried on the way down. They knew what was happening because they'd seen the news and heard it, whereas we had no concept of danger or whatever on arrival. And therefore, and they were very much more miserable. These are the poor old ships that had lost their carpets and curtains and lived in quite monk-like conditions. And this undermined, I think, their own confidence. One ship even ditched all their spirits and beer over the side, which seemed to me an extraordinary thing to do, as the spirit store is well below the waterline, so it certainly wasn't providing a fire hazard. And it did conclude that if you came out of the Falklands successfully, you'd want something to celebrate with. I think the things that stick in my mind thereafter is closely following the land campaign and odd things that happened out at sea. Lieutenant Commander Ward, who is one of the Sea Harrier pilots, CEO of the Sea Harrier Squadron, shot down a C-130. And once again, it's a bit like shooting down a helicopter. It's a defenseless aeroplane. And I remember he came over to see us and just for have a chat around the ships. And he was saying it was a bit like, you know, shooting a dolphin or an albatross. You know, C-130 is a friendly aeroplane. It does good things, even if it's your enemy's aeroplane. And he flew up close alongside the cockpit, invited them all to jump, and basically was given the finger. And he then shot it down with his cannon, and also proved that it's an extremely difficult aeroplane to shoot down. And he virtually had to saw the wing off with the cannon to get the aeroplane to go down. And I remember him saying it wasn't his happiest kill. There was another Vulcan strike, which on the 3rd of June, which was as unsuccessful as the previous one. Well, that didn't surprise us the second time around. And we became sort of paranoid about the continual flow of C-130s, Argentina C-130s, in and out of a standee. We never seem to be able to get one, which says an awful lot for the ability of the Argentinian Hercules pilots, because clearly by this stage their attack aircraft were unwilling to get into a fight with Sea Harriers, and if there were Sea Harriers around, they would just go away. And I suppose it was their last good day was the for the Argentine aeroplanes was the 8th of June. Now, obviously you're aware from what I've been saying that we had very good intelligence of aeroplanes taking off from Argentina. And indeed, we've been involved in one operation when ourselves and Invincible, it's the only time that we escorted Invincible, steamed south of the Falklands, well to the west, to put a Sea King into the Tierra del Fuego, whose purpose was to land SAS to continue intelligence work on the southern airfields. And therefore, the information we're getting at back, both from SAS in their reconnaissance role and from the submarines off the Argentinian coast, was really quite quite comprehensive. And the day that the Sir Tristram and Galahad were attacked, we were certainly aware in Broadsword, where we had, as I said, some very competent officers, of the takeoff of a large number of air raids on clearly Sir Tristram and Sir Galahad. We were aware of the, in Broadsword, of the disagreements between the Commodore in charge of the amphibious landings and between Admiral Woodward in overall charge of naval operations and indeed Northwood as to the use of Fearless and Intrepid and the LSLs and the movement of troops, large numbers of troops around the coast of Falklands by sea. And we knew that Sir Tristram and Galahad were in Choiseul Sound. And therefore, we were not surprised when there was a major Argentinian air effort, because they must have been sighted, to attack them. And you don't have to be a genius to work out the distance between the airfields and the appropriate target. Nor do you therefore have to be a genius to work out what time you have to launch your own aeroplanes to provide an intercept. And we became quite concerned in Broadsword when no aircraft were being launched from Invincible and Hermes to provide air defense of Choiseul Sound and the Galahad and the Sir Tristram. And indeed my opposite number, a chap called Roy Birch, who had been a fighter controller, called up the Invincible and said, I really believe that if you don't launch combat air patrol to support the Sir Tristram and Sir Galahad in the next 10 minutes, it's going to be too late. And he was told to mind his own business. And I'm afraid that eventually Invincible did launch combat air patrol, but 20 minutes too late. And they were only able to take out some aircraft from the second or third wave of attacking Argentinians after they had attacked Sir Galahad and Sir Tristram. And we were really quite quite angry about that. As just as a bystander, we were aware of the dangers to these ships, and it seemed to us that our flagship was ignoring it. And there were more than sufficient Sea Harriers by then, and GR3s, and more than a sufficient number of pilots, many of whom were not getting in that many flying hours. And we think there was an error in judgment in the Invincible. But that's not one that I've seen raised in books on that particular event since, which is a bit sad. However, thereafter, I mean, that was really the end of the Argentine air effort, except the last Exocet attack, which was on the 12th of... No, there were two more. There was the 12th of June when Glamorgan was hit by an Exocet. And that was interesting because Glamorgan was with the Avenger, Yarmouth and the Arrow, conducting naval gunfire support, firing against Stanley Airport. And we knew that the Argentinians had placed Exocets down by the lighthouse. And knowing the range, we knew the area, the range of exercise, we knew the area in which we should not go. And there'd been a general signal to all the ships saying, thou shalt not go into this danger exercise area. After the Glamorgan had finished her gunfire support, she formed the Avenger, Yarmouth and Arrow, up into line ahead. And the plan was to return at high speed to the task group. Glamorgan, by all accounts, cut the corner on this danger area and received an exocet, the story of which is well known. It didn't severely damage the Glamorgan, it didn't put her out of action significantly, although of course it did kill a number of people on board. And Avenger, Yarmouth and Arrow did not follow her through the danger area and refused to go in it. It was a fairly vitriolic conversation between the commanding officers of the ships the following day, saying that, you know, oh, Glamorgan, you should not have gone there. We refuse to follow you. And if it comes to any sort of disciplinary action, don't expect us to support you. Which was an interesting conversation to listen on a radio net between the commanding officer of the Glamorgan and the commanding officer of the Avenger. We were still surprised to see Glamorgan take that risk. But they'd done so much, the Glamorgan, and been involved in naval gunfire support so often that I suspect they had reached a stage where of overconfidence. And of course then there was the last exocet attack, which I probably missed because it was talking about, but it was I think at the end of May when the task group had its last exocet attack. Which was fortunately unsuccessful. I can't specifically remember the day that I'm looking for it in my notes. I can't remember the day, but it was really towards the end of the war. But it was the last throw by the Argentine Navy to get an aircraft carrier. And indeed, this was the event when they claimed they had actually hit the Invincible. But the style of attack was very similar to the one that hit the Sheffield. And the Argentinians approached from the southwest, and they followed the usual mode of attack for this type of raid. As I remember, it was one Super 8 Andard accompanied by two or three A4s. And the Super 8 Andard popped up and turned on his radar, which was detected by our own surveillance measures, and he fired his exocet missile, which was detected. But by deploying the decoys in the right fashion, the missile missed the outer screen of ships and was never seen again. We think actually it just ran out of steam. Or the swell of the sea was such that the missile couldn't cope with it and eventually flew into the sea. And then I think one aircraft was shot down, the others dropped their bombs and flew home. It was this attack where the Argentine A4 pilot claimed he'd flown down the deck of the Invincible and dropped bombs on it. Now, they never penetrated the outer screen of ships, which was some 25 miles away from Invincible and Hermes. And to get to Invincible, they'd had to have flown past us. And they didn't. So it was a very boastful claim to say that he'd actually hit the Invincible and seen it on fire. And I know they've painted a picture of the event and it hangs in an Argentinian Navy mess. But there is absolutely no truth in it whatsoever, which is a bit of a puzzle. And if I had any criticism of the Argentinian pilots, is the fact they're even worse at embellishing their stories than raw Navy ones. And the most vital thing in any action is to get a proper and accurate debrief. And it was quite clear that Argentinian pilots were not debriefing their intelligence staff on return accurately. And therefore, many of them were arriving at what they thought was a defeated task group with very little air defences to find an undefeated task group with rigid air defences. And this meant that many of them found it more difficult to cope with the stress of their attack than they anticipated. That they had to fly down valleys that were covered in missiles and gun air defences, and they had to come out against ships that were well protected by aircraft, they chose the prudent way out, which was not to get engaged, not to get involved in an engagement which they couldn't win, and go for home. And it sums up, you know, getting yourself hoist by your own petard, and this particular man claiming he had sunk the Invincible. The implications of that for the British air defences would have been disastrous. And if you then plan further operations on the fact that half British air defences have gone, or aircraft have gone, and they haven't, that means you'll get all your planning wrong. And I suspect this is one of the many reasons that so many of their aircraft were lost.
We hear quite a lot about the need for counselling of people after being in combat. What do you feel about that after your experience in the Falklands?
I'm not sure that actually the counsellors think that people need counselling. If you have a good ship's company and one that is the people are reasonably well balanced, then you talk through what's happened afterwards, and that in itself is a very good form of self-counselling, for want of a better word. And it inevitably produces a closeness with the people who are at the event. But certainly no one in broadsword, other than one sailor I've mentioned, needed any form of counselling. We were involved in a number of actions and saw a number of aeroplanes shot down and bodies and things in the water, but I don't think anybody was particularly shocked or surprised by it, and certainly not to the extent that counselling was needed. Rather summed up by a nice story I heard on the radio only this year, where a merchant navy seaman from the Second World War had the misfortune to be torpedoed, was picked up by another merchant ship, which was itself torpedoed the same day, and was picked up by another, which returned him to Bristol. And his interviewer said, "Do you not feel, you know, that that was the end of your war and it was all very traumatic and you didn't want to go it again and so forth and you needed counselling help?" To which his answer was, "Of course I bloody well didn't. You know, I went straight down the docks and signed on the next ship." He said, "There was a war on, we had a job to do." He said, "Counselling, what for?" You know, I think the thing is that if you're able to talk about it, and you had to remember that when we came back from the Falklands, we had the entire length of the South and North Atlantic to steam, to come back and relax. By getting our photographs printed so that we could see them before we got back, and we had a vast number of photographs taken, and by sort of writing our own booklet of what we thought had gone on, and by talking to each other and relaxing and not and winding down from having a proper wind-down period as a group together, is that we were much better placed when we returned home than perhaps some other people. We came back in our own ship, and it was perfectly serviceable. We were all alive. Nobody had been seriously injured. Nobody had left us. Nobody had been killed, fortunately. And those who had been injured had gone off to be patched up, had come back, and were still fully mobile and able to do their job. That even on the way back, we decided that we would take up one of our lost weekends in Gibraltar, so we didn't come straight back to UK. We went and had a 3-day stopover in Gibraltar to have a major wind down. And once we had a very quiet entry to Gibraltar, because they weren't, the Gibraltarians and the Navy in Gibraltar weren't quite sure how to receive us, that they gave us a tremendous send off. There were lots of parties. And interestingly enough,